But tonight I'm very happy to welcome Catherine Hastein here to Many Rivers Books and Tea. She is the current poet laureate of Sonoma County, 2014 to 2016, right?
Correct.
Yeah. She's a wonderful poet and artist, and I've been to her poetry readings before, and thank you very much for coming to Many Rivers.
My pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Is he, like, not the sweetest winner thing you can have? I just love you. And a little reminder of what Robert Hess taught us once at a Word Temple reading was that if everyone who walked into a bookstore would buy just one greeting card, they would stay in business forever. So if you can't do a book tonight, and if you can do a card, some little trinket, go for it. We like supporting the store. Yeah. So thank you all for coming. I thought on a beautiful summer evening like this, there might be me and Kathy here. So it's good to see so many familiar faces. So I had this great idea of presenting some of my favorite poets that have either read at the Word Temple Poetry Series over the last 10 years now, or been on my radio show over the last 9 years now. And so I sent my idea off to Jim, and yay. Then I started putting this together, and I was like, are you nuts? How are you going to present your favorite poets in 45 minutes? You know, it can't happen. It's impossible. So if this works, I may do something again. But what I decided to do for tonight is to just kind of narrow it down to a list of a handful of poets that focus on being witnesses. And for the most part, they write most of their poetry in free verse. That's all I could do. And I'm still leaving out probably 70 poets that, you know, that I would like to present. We're going to take questions at the end, but to save time, I'm going to ask you to, like, hold off until then. And this is how I'm going to start.
Voices on the waves. I'm reading Greek poetry. The sea. horses weep in it, the horses of the curious weep in it, here by the sea in San Francisco, where the waves weep. They make a sibilant sound, a simmering sound, and they whisper,
pardon the pun, I've killed two poets with one stone. There's Allen Ginsberg that I'm not going to talk about tonight, but that was Lawrence Ferlinghetti reading his poem, Allen Ginsberg is Dying. And, you know, probably because I was raised in San Francisco, Lawrence Ferlinghetti has been one of my all-time favorites for a long time. And I've had the honor of getting to know a number of poets over the 10 years, and he's one of them. We'd meet for dinner and we'd walk from either his apartment in North Beach to a restaurant or from Cafe Trieste, where he'd say, Catherine, let's meet for a root beer float, which to him means Chianti. And then, you know, we'd walk to the restaurant, and on the way, we'd be talking and walking, and all of a sudden, he just stops. And he watches a Chinese-American family unload from a car, little girls with their white bobby socks, and he watches. And then he turns to me and he says, there's a poem. Uh-huh. Now, he is a poem of witness, big time. I'm going to read one of his poems out of this very sweet little chapbook that was published when he was made San Francisco Poet Laureate. And the poem is called Dog. The dog trots freely in the street and sees reality, and the things he sees are bigger than himself, and the things he sees are his reality. Drunks in doorways, moons on trees. The dog trots freely through the street, and the things he sees are smaller than himself. Fish on newsprint, ants in holes, chickens in Chinatown windows, their heads a block away. The dog trots freely in the street, and the things he smells smell something like himself. The dog trots freely in the street, past puddles and babies, cats and cigars, pool rooms and policemen. He doesn't hate cops, he merely has no use for them. And he goes past them and past the dead cows hung up whole in front of the San Francisco meat market. He would rather eat a tender cow than a tough policeman, though either might do. And he goes past the Romeo Ravioli Factory and past Congressman Doyle of the Un-American Committee. He's afraid of Coit's Tower, but he's not afraid of Congressman Doyle, although what he hears is very discouraging, very depressing, very absurd to a sad young dog like himself, to a serious dog like himself. But he has his own free world to live in, his own fleas to eat. He will not be muzzled. Congressman Doyle is just another fire hydrant to him. The dog trots freely in the street and has his own dog's life to live and to think about and to reflect upon, touching and tasting and testing everything, investigating everything without benefit of perjury. A real realist with a real tale to tell, with a real tale to tell it with, a real live barking democratic dog, engaged in real free enterprise, with something to say about ontology, something to say about reality, and how to see it, and how to hear it, with his head cocked sideways at street corners, as if he is just about to have his picture taken for Victor Records, listening for his master's voice, and looking like a living question mark into the great gramophone of puzzling existence, with its wondrous hollow horn, which always seems just about to spout forth. That's Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Now, here is something I want to show you. If you were to talk to him today, he's 96 years old now, he would say, yeah, I'm a poet, but really I'm a painter. That's what I am. And this is a print of his painting, The Dawn is a Mirror of Myself. It was at the Kresge Gallery in San Francisco for quite a while before that closed down. And I'm going to read a short poem of my own from Nighthawks. It's an ekphrastic poem that is based on this painting. The dawn is a mirror of myself. Not just any dawn. A San Francisco dawn, the sun blushing through the soft burn of fog floating low over the water, between the Isle of Angels and North Beach, Bohemia. It's time to tune in to a silver waltz or something slower, to allow our bodies what they wish most, to ease back with nowhere but here, wings folded beneath the canvas, sated from dreams of love and sublimity. The whole scene, a breathless hush of rose and release, a tidal wave of it, recorded for time. Dawn's skin, made of earth and heaven, warms, is perfectly moist to the touch. So again, that is from this lovely painting. So I'm going to move on to the next poet. In 2007, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Carolyn Kaiser came to read at the Word Temple Poetry Series. Was anybody there that's in the room?
Yes.
Two of you. So she came to read from her book, Cool, Calm, and Collected. Now, those of you of a certain age who had the television on, maybe in the 50s, early 60s, would recognize this phrase from an arid, extra dry ad for women's perspiration. We stay cool, calm, and collected. And this tells you the kind of wit that Carolyn Kaiser had. She was already suffering from age-related dementia at the time of that reading, and her husband, John Woodbridge, who died last year, warned me that she may need a little help knowing when to stop reading. And so she read for about 30 minutes, and it was an incredible reading. And after about 30 minutes, I did have to stand up, and I faced the audience and did this, and everybody stood and gave her a standing ovation as John wheeled her out, and she was so happy. Several years later, I got to go to her home and record a radio show. And it was an incredible experience. Her disease had progressed. I asked her a lot of questions. She could not find the answers. She just couldn't find them. So I handed her book, and I said, would you read some of your poems? Sure, she says. She opens the book, she looks down, closes it, looks up, and recites poem after poem after poem. It was all there. Just gave me chills all over my body. The woman was a poet through and through. So then on October 23rd of 2013, I brought the poet Annie Finch and Joyce Jenkins from Poetry Flash with me to the boarding care home where Carolyn was staying and where she died. And the people at the boarding care home said, don't bother. You know, they just don't bother. She doesn't respond. And we said, the heck with you. And we went. And we sat at a dining room table and we read her poems to her. We took turns reading poems. And she sat there smiling, and for an hour she didn't say a word, but she was smiling. When we went to leave, she reached out to us, big smile on her face, and said, thank you. Thank you. So it was magical. Annie Finch wrote an essay about that visit that is on the website of the Poetry Foundation. So I want to read a poem by Carolyn Kaiser. If you don't know her work, you gotta. She does write in form, and she writes in free verse. This one is free verse. In the first stanza, first I tell you who I am, shadowed, reflective, small pool in an unknown glade. It is easy to be a poet, brim with transparent water. In autumn, the leaves blow down over the ruffled surface, sink to rest, then resume their cycle. In the second stanza, you laugh, skipping pebbles across my surface, charmed by the spreading circles. In the tree's perpetual twilight, you are alone with a poet. Gently, you shake your head. You know me as turbulent ocean, clouded with thunder and drama. In the third stanza, I die. Still, I insist on composing as my throes go on and on. I clench the pen in my teeth, making those furious scratches that you will see much later as graceful calligraphy, drift of sails that sketch my horizon. My hands in the fourth stanza, with the agonized clutch of the dying, draw your hand beneath the covers. I beg you to travel my body till you find the forest glade. Then your hand, like a leaf in autumn, is pulled into the pool. The rest of you doesn't believe it. The fifth stanza begins with water and quiet laughter. Then I die. I really die. You pick up this piece of paper. You read it aloud and explain me, my profile cast in prose. It drops from your hand like a leaf. This is all part of the cycle. Then, in the final stanza, I tell you who I am. Carolyn Kaiser. Next. But first I need a slug of water. Y'all doing okay?
Y'all?
Where'd that come from?
Your brief time at Santa.
Yeah, exactly. So some of my favorite shows on Word Temple are recordings of people who are no longer with us in body. I've aired, for an example, a reading by Langston Hughes that he gave at UC Berkeley in 1962. It's one of my favorite shows. And I've aired our wonderful Poet Laureate Emeritus David Bromwich. I love hearing his voice still. Sometimes I break away from poetry altogether if I feel like it's important enough. And an example of this would be a discussion that took place between Malcolm X and James Baldwin. So I'm going to ask you to indulge with me for a minute. They are addressing sit-ins and what makes a man. Mr. X was still under the influence of Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam that would eventually assassinate him. And he was he was traveling all over the country teaching the ideas of Elijah Muhammad. And then there's James Baldwin, who has a very different response to sit-ins and the notion of sit-ins and what makes a man. So I'm going to move this to, you're going to hear Malcolm X's voice, and I'm just going to do this very briefly, but I want you to hear these men. This is Malcolm X.
One of the reasons that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in teaching us here in America, is giving us a solution that differs drastically from the sit-in movement, is trying to make us men. Now, the very fact that you find students all over the world today are standing up for their rights and fighting for their rights. But here in America, the so-called Negro students have allowed themselves to be maneuvered under a tag of sit-in. The word sit itself is not an honorable tag. Anybody can sit. An old woman can sit. A coward can sit. A baby can sit. Anything can sit. But it takes a man to stand. And when they attach this sit-in term or title to this movement, it stigmatizes it. And it stigmatizes it, in my opinion.
Is this the passivity of it that you object to?
Well,
so that was Malcolm X. Brilliant, brilliant man. has a reputation for being a violent man, which he was not. And now I'm going to move way ahead to James Baldwin. How many of you here have read James Baldwin? Yay! Yay! I just reread The Fire Next Time and No Name on the Street. If you haven't read those, get them. Okay. Come here, Jimmy. Where are you? Okay, so James Baldwin.
Only armed with the color of his skin, the only thing that really arms anybody when the chips are down is how closely, how thoroughly he can relate to himself and view the world, yes, as a man, you know. But I don't think, when I talk about standards, I say that all that be revised is one of the standards that had to be revised. I don't think that a warrior is necessarily a man. In fact, it has been proven that football players and all these people in teams and in armies are not men. It is very difficult to be a man. And what it involves, for me, anyway, is an ability to look at the world, to look at whatever it is, and to say what it is, and to deal with it, to face it, even if it does mean laying down your life, in a way it always does mean that. But I don't want, this is part of the only reason I'm here this afternoon, what I would not like to see, this thousand-year nightmare begin all over again, with a shoe on the other foot. In a way, this is personal, but I had to understand, for my own survival, that the things that had been done to me when I was a child, and the things that had been done to my ancestors, I was now responsible for all these things. It was too bad that my father beat me, and too bad, and absolutely unforgivable, unforgettable. It's the way that the history has been so awful, but it is now, when you become a man, your responsibility to deal with it. I cannot undo it by repeating it. I cannot hurt you.
I have such a hard time turning that off. So, that's a good example of like a favorite show that has nothing to do with poetry. Except that now there is going to be something that has to do with poetry. Because despite his very famous novels and his memoirs and essays, James Baldwin was a poet as well, and a lot of people feel that he was a poet first before anything. He wrote poetry all his life, and he just cared so deeply about words and the work that words could do. And he very often wrote his poetry in what they call countermetrically, so that the rhythms of his poetry would reflect his African, Southern, Paris roots, you name it, Harlem, all of it. So he wrote his poems very, plain speak. He never flinched from just saying what it is. No flowery metaphors. In one poem, he's listening to a woman talk against abortion, and the woman says, "I always feel like that's killing somebody." So Baldwin responds in a poem with his own question about killing. "That's right, up to our ass and niggers on death row." Okay, so he did not hesitate. He referred to America as the very last white country in the world. Recently, Beacon Press reissued Jimmy's Blues, which is a wonderful, wonderful collection of his poems. I'm so grateful that they did this. What I'd like to do is read the entire open poem called Stagger Lee Wonders, but I can't. So I'm just going, how did all these things get in here? So I'm just going to read a short part. Now, what this will show you, he wrote about very serious issues. Obviously, he came from a very serious background, but the man laughed, he said, the whole time he wrote this book. He laughed. He was in Paris when he wrote these poems. So this is just a little snippet of Stagger Lee Wonders. "Lord, I watch the alabaster lady of the house with Beulah. Beulah, about 60, built four square, biceps like Muhammad Ali, She at the stove, fixing biscuits, scrambling eggs and bacon, fixing coffee, pouring juice, and the lady of the house, she say she don't know how she'd get along without Beulah, and Beulah just silently grunts, I reckon you don't, and keeps on keeping on. And the lady of the house say, she just like one of the family. And Beulah turns, gives me a look, sucks her teeth, and rolls her eyes in the direction of the lady's back, and keeps on keeping on. So James Baldwin was a gay man. So here he is. He's an African American. He's come up through this horrible background, and he's a gay man during this time. And you know, if you've read his novels like Giovanni's Room, you know lots of stories. Here's a poem that he wrote called Guilt, Desire, and Love. At the dark street corner where guilt and desire are attempting to stare each other down, presently one of them will light a cigarette and glance in the direction of the abandoned warehouse. Love came slouching along, an exploded silence, standing a little apart but visible anyway in the yellow, silent, steaming light, while guilt and desire wrangled, trying not to be overheard by this trespasser. Each time desire looked towards love, hoping to find a witness, guilt shouted louder and shook them hips, and the fire of the cigarette threatened to burn the warehouse down. Desire actually started across the street, time after time, to hear what love might have to say, but guilt flagged down a truckload of other people and knelt down in the middle of the street, and while the truckload of other people looked away and swore that they didn't see nothing and couldn't testify nohow, and love moved out of sight, guilt accomplished upon the standing body of desire the momentary, inflammatory soothing which seals their union forever and creates a mighty traffic problem. So, Baldwin visited San Francisco in 1963, and at that time he said to somebody that certainly there would be a black president of the United States someday, but it would be a very different country. And I have to wonder how different he would think it would be when we see depictions of President Obama as an ape, or worse, as Hitler. And personally, I think the most important use of cell phones these days is recording violence and really getting it to the forefront. Because if it isn't, then these stories either don't make it to the newspaper or they get hidden away. You know, maybe this much space somewhere. So this is a poem called Everything We Read. Darkness at the door, someone down, a lament of casings rustle along the curb, break the bread past the policeman. The moon stares with empty eyes, the end is less than a hair, less than a feather floating up. Just a sentence beneath an ad, the bottom corner of the seventh page. In blue waters, young men mirrored, they have traveled the underground rivers of blood blooms everlasting, media sniffing at the color line, good short story, the count. Enough to strike the fear in, enough to nail the lie in, just. Genius does not grow in newspapers. Little as we know you not at all. Have forgotten conveniently the connection of sacred roots entwined. All of us in our cells composed of universe, our atoms used, reused millions of times. In baffled oneness, ghosts drift quietly, gaze down through the rattling of wind through bones, the tender knitting of earth. On to the next poet. I'm going to take you back to the 70s and 80s for a minute. If you don't remember them, you were probably there. So this is when women's bookstores were inhaling and exhaling words by women, music by women, art by women, newspapers by women. There was so much going on. It was just, it felt like this great explosion. It was very powerful. Old Wives Tales on Valencia Street, a woman's bookstore, was one of my favorite hangouts. You never knew who you were going to hear, what you were going to hear, what you were going to learn, and how it related to your own story for once. It was wonderful. We had been really isolated as women and in some cases as lesbians for so long, and now there was Judy Gronn. She was a goddess. She was a goddess to us. In 1969, she wrote a series of poems called the Common Woman poems. They were a call for women of all classes to come together, classes, races, backgrounds, and she wanted women to form an alliance of power, politically, socially, any way possible. When her book Love Belongs to Those Who Do the Feeling came out in 2008, she made her second of three or four trips to Word Temple. At that time, she wrote, "Today, women have come a long way into the public sphere and need to go much further. We need to be leading the countries, guiding them in some new directions. We need women's values, especially the values of mothers, guiding collective humanity, not simply the rise of individual women. And we must do this while holding families together. So this requires the caring participation and support of men. This is indeed a large oath, which is why it is emphasized in the Common Woman." So I want to read one of those Common Woman poems, and then I'll read a couple of others by Judy Gronn. This was based on a real person, Vera from my childhood. "Solemnly swearing to swear as an oath to you, who have somehow gotten to be a pale old woman, swearing as if an oath could be wrapped around your shoulders like a new coat. For your $28 a week and the bastard boss you never let yourself hate, and the work, all the work you did at home where you never got paid. For your mouth that got thinner and thinner until it disappeared as if you had choked on it, watching the hard liquor break your fine husband down into a dead joke. For the strange mole, like a third eye, right in the middle of your forehead. For your religion, which insisted that people are beautiful golden birds and must be preserved. For your persistent nerve and plain white talk. The common woman is as common as good bread, as common as when you couldn't go on but did. For all the world we didn't know, we held in common all along. The common woman is as common as the best of bread, and will rise, and will become strong. I swear it to you. I swear it to you on my own head. I swear it to you on my common woman's head." This poem was so popular that some women went out and they made posters of it and they plastered them all over. But one woman changed it because she thought, well, common is as the best of bread? That's not very, you know, that doesn't say very much about us. And Judy Gronn countered and said, the best of bread is communion bread. Right? So that's pretty good. That's pretty good. So I'm going to read a couple of more by her. She has a great sense of humor. I love just watching her walk into the room. She's got these twinkly, twinkly eyes, you know. It was kind of a surprise to me that she'd be all serious. She's not. "Love, you wicked dog. Love, you wicked dog, so handsome to look at, so awkward close up, and so unfaithful to good sense. Whoever feeds you attention gets you, like it or not. And all your bad habits come with you like a pack of fleas. Wherever I turn for peace of mind, there is the love dog scratching at my door of my lonesomeness, beating her tail against the leg of my heart, and panting all night with red breath in my dreams. Love dog, get in or out of the house of my life. Stop chewing on my belongings, the papers, and shoes of my independence. So she also cares very deeply about the planet, and she has a lot of work reflecting that. I'm going to read. Think what a butterfly. Think what a butterfly does to our life that's elemental. There is nothing substantial about a butterfly. It doesn't feed you or give you a bed. It doesn't remember what street we live on or how old you are. There is nothing about a butterfly we would want to take to the insurance adjuster. Nothing incremental. But think what a butterfly gives us of delight. Think what surprise in that flutter of life, and how amazing the colors. Who would ever have imagined such combinations as a butterfly takes for granted in its short display of light play and that sacramental face, those sensitive antennae connecting to our inner eyes. There are dances, notions, and inspirations we can't know, except for butterflies, that we can't know when there are no butterflies, when life is detrimental, and when the habitat of butterflies, is so destroyed. What is the covenant we must have with butterflies? So, she touched on a lot of issues, and I'm going to read a new poem that's in my next book called Fossil. And it was people like Judy Grun that would give us the courage to write poems like this. And I want to tell you that, in case you don't know, Eridu is a goddess of hatred, Aphrodite, a goddess of love. Fossil. A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. William Blake. There was the time Eridu called in Aphrodite, who was so new and light-filled with her love, and said, I know who you are and what you are, and I'll do everything I can to get you out of here. You'll never work again. Her job, as she saw it, was to send Aphrodite running as fast as anyone could run, filled with the weight, the 10-ton weight of self-loathing, of self-hate. No one was allowed to speak to the young lover. No one was allowed to listen to her, either. She was placed in a palace of fear and ignorance for 8 hours each day. One round-eyed waif of a girl whispered, I'm sorry I told her you love women. I didn't know she'd despise you so. What is proved, saith Blake, was once only imagined. Aphrodite buzzed her hair, put on a tie, gnashed her teeth beneath half-closed eyes, and breathed to the poisoned air, all the while doing her job perfectly, 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 each minute of eternity. What is an office, after all, and what is theater? She played her part thus, until Eridu, old for her years, retired to Florida to join the other storm clouds and bitter tempests. But as all gods and goddesses of hate do, she held her battle tight in her gnarled hands, and one day traveled back to California to an office where Aphrodite worked anew. Their eyes met as she stalked through the door, a drop of spittle in the corner of her cunning grin. I told you, it said, you'd never work again. She met with Aphrodite's boss man for quite some time, and then he invited her to join them. You already know each other, he said. Eridu, who calls herself Anne, will work here as a consultant to help us restructure our department. Lovely, cried Aphrodite. She returned to her desk, thinking the world is a grain of sand, and watched the minutes drag around the clock. Anne left rosy-cheeked, joyous in the coming war. But it never happened. For Aphrodite told the boss man everything, and it turned out he was queer too. She'll never work here, he said. And she didn't. Once again, thought Aphrodite, Blake had it right. Excessive sorrow laughs, excessive joy weeps. All right, so those of you who have come to Word Temple over the years know that one of my favorite events is what I call Translation Night. There are so many poets we would not know about or hear if it wasn't for the great translators in our midst who are also willing to come to Sonoma County to read for us. And it was really hard to choose. There's just so many, but I had to choose somebody. So I am choosing this man. This is a poet. His name is Zbigniew Herbert. And he was translated by Alisa Vallis. I'm going to give you too little information about him. He was born in Poland in 1924. In 1939, Poland was occupied by the Soviets, and many of Herbert's instructors in his school either died or they were sent off to as prisoners. In 1940, there were massive deportations of Poles to Soviet camps. In 1941, Hitler's forces attacked, occupying eastern Poland, which is where he grew up, where his family was. But, you know, they made it through that. He continued studying. He joined the underground resistance. In 1944, he leaves to settle in Krakow to study. By 1952, he's selling his own blood so he can eat. By 1964, he begins winning prize after prize after prize. Life changes. He won the T.S. Eliot Prize. He won all kinds of major prizes. His last book was called Epilogue to a Storm, and it was published in the spring of 1998, and he died that July. I want to read two poems by Zbigniew Herbert. I want you to really pay attention to the last two lines of the poem, especially. Two drops. No time to grieve for roses when the forests are burning. Julius Slowacki. The forests were on fire. They, however, wreathed their necks with their hands like bouquets of roses. People ran to the shelters. He said his wife had hair in whose depths one could hide. Covered by one blanket, they whispered shameless words, the litany of those who love. When it got very bad, they leapt into each other's eyes and shut them firmly. So firmly, they did not feel the flames when they came up to the eyelashes. To the end, they were brave. To the end, they were faithful. To the end, they were similar, like two drops stuck at the edge of a face. My God, you know, I mean, that kind of imagery is what T.S. Eliot talked about, you know, when we want to express our deepest emotions rather than saying, oh, I'm so sad, you know, I'm so this, I'm so that. Here is this, like two drops stuck at the edge of a face. He was just brilliant. Despite all of his background, he had a real lightness about him also. And since I'm reading from a translated work, I'm going to read his poem called On Translating Poetry. Like a clumsy bumblebee, he alights on a flower, bending the fragile stem. He elbows his way through rows of petals like pages of a dictionary. He wants in where the fragrance and sweetness are, and though he has a cold and can't taste anything, he pushes on until he bumps his head against the yellow pistol. And that's as far as he gets. It's too hard to push through the calyx into the root. So the bee takes off again. He emerges swaggering, loudly humming, I was in there, and those who don't take his word for it can take a look at his nose, yellow with pollen. So we're coming around the last bend. We have a few more here. Are you doing okay?
Mm-hmm.
Doing all right? Okay, good. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to indulge me again for a minute as I bring in one poet I've never had at the Word Temple Poetry Series, because he's gone. And I've never had him on my radio show because, tragically, there's just no recording of him reading either his poetry, his essays, anything that I can find. And this is Federico Garcia Lorca, one of the most famous poets in all of Spain, in all of the world, and he is the poet that is the deepest in my heart. He was just magnificent, and he was a gay man, and he was a man in Spain who was against the nationalist regime of General Franco, and he was executed by Franco's death squads at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War in 1936. So here is the only recording of him I have. This is the only way to get close to him in a recording. And what you are going to hear is Federico Garcia Lorca playing piano, accompanying the most famous flamenco singer at the time, La Argentina. Federico. There he is. So I'm going to read two of my own poems that were inspired by Lorca. The first addresses an archaeological dig that is taking place right now. There have been a number of digs in the past. Each time they thought they were going to find his bones, and they haven't. But there's another one going on right now in southern Spain. And, you know, it will be a mass grave. If it is a grave, it will be a mass grave. The form of the poem is what I'm calling a broken sonnet. And what I did was I took the last word of each line of the corresponding Shakespeare sonnet. And then that's all it has in common with it. The second poem I'm going to read addresses the fact that very recently, I believe the end of 2012, we discovered the name of Lorca's last lover. And this is really important news because Lorca knew he was pegged for assassination. He could have left Spain. His plan was to flee to Mexico, but he fell in love with a man who was under 21. He was a minor, and he didn't want to leave him, so he stayed. So I'm going to read these two poems. The sonnet number is 147. In the hills over Granada, where my old friends, the crickets, still tremble in ribbons, they are digging up my bones. Disease of history and its bloody lens, media vent, ill eyeball of mystery, dig us all up, all the missing dreams, please. Sweet little Lorca bones, you are no sweeter than the rest of love lost here. The toothless smiles and sunflowers mistaken for men, kept in this terminal of death. We all climb the ladder ceaselessly, approve every adornment of heartache, every infusion of magico, except for the roots of memory shaped like tongues, crying, fire! Take care with the hoe, with the sieve. Lift with caution our particles of unrest. Whisper, let me see you, poet. Let me see you, preciosa. We are gypsies forging, dancers sobbing, winds exploding, expressed flames encircling you. Angels all, we heave our nakedness, our bright dove-white nakedness, uncoil the vertex of mad voices in the night. A couple of things on the next poem. Its title is Menor, which is minor. And there is a line in the poem, Ay vos secreto del amor oscuro, which translate to, oh, secret voice of dark love. So the reason we found out about his last lover was he died, and he had a box full of letters from Lorca that he gave to his daughter, and here we have it. Menor, look, they are lying in ambush for us still. From the beloved sleeps on the poet's breast, Federico García Lorca. After 70 years, García Lorca, the stars have brought us the name of your last love. The dusk of nightingales, the soft-necked dove, his name, your trembling flesh, all in a box, sheltered from eyes that would eat you whole. Juan, you whispered, Juan, here is my breast, a broken moon, the dahlia of my blood. García Lorca, but for this boy, the underground cell of your center, you may have left Spain, may not have been executed with the bullfighters and one-legged schoolteacher. The more we know, the more the clouds fill our mouths. Poeta, poeta. In the box, an orange blossom from Granada, a testament of desperate desire. I can't even look at him, you say. Do we wish you hadn't? No. We cradle the coffin of poems and letters. Ay, vos secreto del amor oscuro. We resume looking for your bones, the hard ivory of your head. We cannot break our mourning for the lily lost before the bloom. Poeta dulce, ¿dónde está? Sweet poet, where are you? And I'm going to end on a lighter note with one last poem. So my next book is called Shakespeare and Stein Walk into a Bar. And there are a lot of these broken sonnets in it. The Stein, of course, refers to Gertrude Stein. So she shows up quite a bit in the book. So here is sonnet number 4, Shakespeare and Stein. Okay. Shakespeare and Stein walk into a bar. They spend in the bar a day or two or a day times 4 talking legacy. Low, 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 saith William, pointing to his thunder. Lend me the stars and I will set them wherefore, etc. to be free. Gertrude 4 times in 4 ways says, Alice, Alice, Alice. Abuse not my ears, says Shakespeare, for my name is ungored. Give me 14 straight lines, too indented, like so to use, and I wilt see thyself in decay. You say you live, you say you live, Gertrude in a bar sniffs on a stool with 4 legs. Alone is alone is alone, I say. Will over an olive. Don't deceive yourself, Gertie. The gracious light shines on me. Gone are the gusts of your lifting belly and tender buttons. They leave. Windows reflect 2 bards breasting through their pain. Thee, they whisper in unbarred shadows. Ye, you, thee will always be. Thank you very much.